Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Great War of 1914 to 1918 came to an end 100 years ago this Sunday, November 11th. Augustana University Professor Dr. Patrick Hicks and Augie Professor Dr. Peg Preston are with us now inside the SDPB Sioux Falls studio for a look at how this war helped shape the 20th century. Patrick, Peg, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Now, you're teaching a class on, tell me a little bit about how this this particular piece of history informs your work at Augustana right now, Peg.
Well, Patrick and I have taught a course on the Great War together many years, so this has been going on for quite some time. And we introduced students and provide them a better understanding of the Great War, because what we found is students don't really understand. They don't get a great deal of it in high school. And though it sounds trite to say you can't have World War II without World War I, what they come to understand is really how World War II is really the next battle of World War I. And so we give them and Patrick and I do it very much within a collaborative sense, but particularly more related to our interests. I'm a social and economic historian, Patrick, literature and poetry. And so we don't necessarily look at the Great War from a battle and strategy standpoint, but how it affected society in a broader sense.
I want to get to that, but first, Patrick, let's talk a little bit about how this day will be sort of commemorated across the globe, in Europe especially.
Yeah. Well, and in the United Kingdom in particular, the Great War, as they refer to it as, they don't call it World War I, the Great War, it casts such a profound shadow over the 20th century, and in particular in Britain, as a whole generation of young men just vanished in the fields of France, in particular the heavy losses from the British. So in London on Sunday, the war ended on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month in 1918, and that's when the guns fell silent. So at 11 o'clock in London, and I've witnessed this, it's very powerful. The whole city, almost the whole city, comes to a standstill. You know, the people stop walking, and the bells will toll out, and you'll see everyone wearing poppies, and people will gather around what's called the cenotaph, which was very close to Big Ben, and it's here that everyone will gather and commemorate the war. And the Queen, if she's in good health, she'll lay a wreath there. I mean, mm-hmm. You'll definitely see that on BBC on Sunday.
100 years later.
Yeah.
So this is evidence of a value system of education, of a desire to sort of to remember this forever. What makes it so significant that an entire culture would say this is worth doing 100 years later?
Yeah. It's one of the curiosities of the Great War, because it's not something that really registers in the American consciousness at all, in spite of the fact that we were involved in the war and we suffered tremendous losses in 1917 and 1918. It doesn't register with us. It seems like, you know, World War II is more for us. There's like a lot of power there. But the Great War, it really made American society. It was the rise of us economically. But in Britain, and what I want to get to is kind of the reverse. It was the beginning of the slide of the British losing their empire, not just loss of life, but it was the first sort of cracks within the British Empire. And it's really hard to overestimate just how profoundly this war affected the people of Britain. I mean, almost everybody had a family member that either died or was wounded in the Great War.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just as far as commemoration goes, I mean, I think what Americans don't understand is when they go over to Europe, and you see it certainly in Britain and Ireland, is the city centers will have a central point in which there is a soldier commemorating war, and they often think that must be for World War II, but the truth is that's for World War I. And so the commemoration of this war is very visible on the landscape in European cities.
Go ahead.
If I could just add, I mean, its ghostly imprint is in American society today. We refer to November 11th as Veterans Day, but really it's Armistice Day. We celebrate Veterans Day because of the war ending. And the idea of the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, that was a British idea to commemorate the average soldier that died in the field. No, not a great general that perished or something like that, just the average unknown soldier. And that was a totally new concept. And this unknown soldier is buried at Westminster Abbey. This is where the kings and queens of the United Kingdom have been crowned for almost a millennia. And here we have this unknown soldier. And it's a very moving grave. It's actually raised up a little bit inside Westminster Abbey, and it's the only grave that is raised up and everyone has to sort of walk around. Hmm. So you'll see that as well. But this idea of the Tomb of the Unknown, we have one in Washington, D.C. because of this British idea. It's powerful and lasting.
Give people a foundation of what this war is about, how it begins, what do people really need, what's the essence that we need to know, and then we'll talk a little more about the impact in the 20th century. It's such a big question.
I think, sorry to say it like that. I think, really what we must understand, it goes back to this issue of how World War II is so captured in the American imagination. But for Americans to understand how much World War I not only changed them, though it did, it changed the 20th century. When we look at World War II, when we look at the horror and the slaughter that occurred there, that was occurring in World War I. We have that kind of violence. And Patrick talks about the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. One of the reasons these soldiers were unknown is because the technology of the day that was used during World War I had never been used on that scale or scope, you know, in a war before. And the military leadership did not know how to handle it. And which is why they actually kept thinking that the cavalry would help them win the war, when ultimately they found out that horses could never have, you know, survived that. And so it part of it is just understanding that World War I introduces the 20th century to the kind of vast technology that it will change the next 100 years.
And you've spoken in our conversations before about what human beings are willing to do to each other.
Yeah.
And this is an example of that astonishing fact that people were willing to do things to other people that were unprecedented at that time. Not to say that we did not have a history of, you know, human violence upon violence, but the technology means so much more can be done at once.
Yeah, it was the first war to have aerial combat and aerial bombardment. The flamethrower was invented because of World War I. You know, we're talking about a war that was fought.
That makes me so mad. Like, who invented the flamethrower? I mean, that just, you see some of these things and it's still shocking that somebody would say, this is a weapon I want to use on another person.
Yeah,
my mind can't get around it even
gas
today.
Gas as well, and the tank. I mean, both sides were desperate to break through in this trench. I mean, it was an immobile, passive war. So these soldiers were hunkered down in these trenches, which were waterlogged and disgusting and lice-ridden and rat-infested, and that's where they would stay, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month. It was a very passive war, and in the meantime, they're getting shelled from above. I mean, cloud watching becomes very popular during the day, and at night, that's when they do their work. So it's really hard for us to sort of fathom what this war was like, but it was the furnace that created the 20th century. I mean, we have the rise of Nazism because of World War I. The Soviet Union begins to happen, 1917, like right in the middle of this war. And we have all of these sort of echoes which are going to haunt the rest of the 20th century.
Make the connection between the rise of Nazism and World War I.
Well, Hitler was, he was a corporal, and he was what's known as a runner. So he would run the trenches, and he signed up right from the beginning. So for 4 years, he was involved in the Great War, and so he was living around bodies all of the time, as so many men of his generation. And he was blinded by gas. It affected his vocal cords. That's one reason his voice still sounds a bit strange if you hear recordings of him. But so he fought alongside his fellow Germans and Austrians, and then the war kind of ends, and they felt like they had been stabbed in the back, and they took this bitter resentment, they being the German veterans, back to Germany, and they felt they had been stabbed in the back by the German government. And this fomented a great deal of resentment. And suddenly...
Stabbed in the back how? They weren't given the support they needed? What was their...
Well, you know, I'll say this quickly, and then, you know, maybe... Peg can maybe, you know, talk about this as well. So the Germans, from the German perspective, the soldiers were surprised. I mean, well, why are we giving up? Why is there an armistice? Because not a single enemy boot touched German soil. They had pushed deep into France, and they're like, well, why are we losing this war? Because where's the enemy? You know, Berlin hasn't been overrun. And they felt as if the government back in Berlin had just sort of abdicated and given up while they were willing to keep fighting in the trenches. So that's that sense of being stabbed in the back.
Late in the war, what happens is the Kaiser will ultimately be forced to abdicate, and the those who took over politically are the ones who sue for armistice. This is what results in the soldiers not understanding what's going. You know, they're on the front; they don't understand what's happening at home. And then the new government sues for peace, and so they don't understand why. I think the other thing we have to look at here at this point is the Versailles Treaty. The Versailles Treaty, and increasingly, you know, Britain and France will acknowledge this, punishes Germany for the war. And at the beginning of this anniversary in 2014, they asked a series of World War I historians who caused World War I, and there was no agreement, right? So there is, it isn't as if Germany is blamed for World War I. And so then we get the Versailles Treaty, and Germany is tasked with $33 billion to pay. That's in 18 money. $33 billion to pay. They take down their military to a much smaller number. You know, they were basically within the treaty itself. Germany accepted responsibility for the war, and so Hitler, you know, and the post, you know, and all his veterans. I mean, he was attractive to them because he looked at this and said, "We did not cause this war." And we didn't want it to end, but those people at home did. They stabbed us in the back. Now, of course, what he does is say they were the Jews at home did this. And this is when, you know, I mean, an anti-Semite himself, he turns it, you know, upon the Jews, and that begins his process of his racist anti-Semitic, you know, agenda.
I think tomorrow is the anniversary, the 80th anniversary of the Night of the Broken Glass, which I can't say in German.
And also Kristallnacht.
Thank you.
And it's also the anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. November 9th has like two echoes to it in German history.
What are the lessons? Are there lessons today? And there's so many. That's another huge question. But let's talk about some of the lessons today from the politics of the time, from the rhetoric of the time, from the technology of the time. What are some things that stand out we could talk about?
I guess one of the lessons that I think is an enduring lesson that we should all pay attention to is, and this is Peg's phrase, but I'm going to say it because it's very good. She said, the arrogance of the few would result in the suffering of the many. And that captures World War I so well. You had these politicians and these generals which felt that they knew best, and they were very happy to sacrifice the lives of these young men and not really caring about the cost that would have to their family and to the society back home. And I mean, that is an enduring lesson that I think our nation and all nations really need to pay attention to. When you ask men and women to put on the flag of our nation and go somewhere else, I mean, we need to support them while they're there, and we need to support them when they come home.
Why don't they come home with a desire when the conditions are so horrific? Who comes home with a desire for peace? I mean, this entire generation has been entirely impacted by the loss that this causes. Why wouldn't you see an uprising of never, never again. This is not ever something that we're going to do to each other again.
That's a great question, and difficult to answer. You know, I think we, I mean, if we look, if we go back to thinking about World War One, actually, prior to the beginning of the war in 1912, the world thought itself was at war at that point. And at that moment, a peace movement occurred. There's a famous Frenchman named Jean Jaurès. He was a socialist, but he gathered the people together and energized them to resist this war, and it was successful in 1912. It's not successful in 1914, and it certainly is the question that we must wrestle with. What becomes so difficult that it brings us to battle? What there must be, why cannot we compromise upon these political issues? And it, we remain to struggle with it to the present.
Yeah. And one of the things that my students ask in the lead up to World War II is, why did people capitulate to Hitler so much and just let him, you know, take over countries? Well, that's your answer. I mean, World War I was so horrifying and so horrific. Europe had no stomach to go back to war again. So so that's one reason that Europe capitulated to Hitler until ultimately September 1st, 1939. Britain and France had had enough and they declared war. But one of the curiosities and interesting things is Hitler used something called the Schlieffen Plan, which was a plan for that predates World War One, because Germany has enemies on both sides. And the Schlieffen Plan was, it said, you know, we'll have Paris for lunch and then Moscow for dinner. This idea that we'll attack France first and then we'll take care of Russia. Well, that's exactly what Hitler does. Hitler fights World War One with the Schlieffen Plan, but he has better technology. So he's replaying and redoing World War One. In fact, when France falls, he has the same rail car brought out where the Versailles Treaty was signed and where Germany was humiliated, and that's where he has France surrender. He fixes World War One in his eyes.
Dr. Patrick Hicks and Dr. Peg Preston are professors at Augustana University. We've been talking about this November 11th, which is the 100th anniversary of the end of the Great War, as we remember it, but much more to that story. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.